This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we'll get more on the background of the man who is charged with stabbing a police officer at Flint's airport. Social media might be trying to entice you with ads, but really, they don't want to know you.
They're not trying to understand me in terms of ethnicity in order to really get my heritage. What they're trying to do is sell me a product.
Want to fix healthcare? Get a diverse group together.
People from all walks of life, young, old, professionals, in and outside of healthcare, come together to come up with new solutions for sometimes pretty old problems in healthcare.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howe says Ford is breaking rules.
But they're saying, you know what, we're running this company for the shareholders first, and if we don't, we're going to continue to get pounded in the markets.
But first, let's get a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Coming up this hour, how algorithms shape our lives online.
For example, I'm Danish, but they think I'm Hispanic. And they think I'm Hispanic only because I like tango music on Facebook.
But first, yesterday, a man with a 12-inch knife stabbed a police officer at the Flint airport. He allegedly shouted out in Arabic, "God is great." The FBI says it's investigating the attack as an act of terror. The police officer, bleeding from the neck, fought with his attacker until other officers could restrain him. The officer, Lieutenant Jeff Neville, was treated and he will survive. The man arrested is 50-year-old Amor Fatui. He's from Canada. To learn more about the alleged attacker, we're joined by Steve Rukavina. He's a reporter at the CBC in Montreal. So, Steve, what can you tell us?
We know that he lives in a neighborhood in Montreal that's sometimes referred to as Little Maghreb. So there are a lot of mosques. There are a lot of North African immigrants that live in those neighborhoods. He lives in an apartment with his wife and three children. We know at this hour there are Royal Canadian Mounted Police and Montreal Police at that apartment, but they say they're just there to assist the FBI, which is leading this investigation. They haven't even told us yet if they've searched inside the apartment. And it's also not clear where Amor Fatui's wife and his three children are right now. We've spoken to his landlord and neighbors, and they basically say, as far as they knew, he was a quiet family man, that they're surprised that he would be accused of something like this. And we also obtained a copy of his resume, so we're learning a little bit more about his work background. He had worked in the past as a security guard. Last year, he obtained his license as a commercial truck driver, but it wasn't clear if he had worked doing that yet or not. His resume also says that he had something called a fast card, which allows truck drivers, they can apply for that. And on both sides of the border, they can go through expedited lanes to get across more quickly. To get one of those cards, you do have to go through a rigorous background check, and you're not supposed to have a criminal record. We've run his name. He doesn't have a criminal record in Canada, as far as we know. We also have some information from the court appearance that he made yesterday. And apparently at that court appearance, he said he understands English, but mostly speaks French. So there was a bit of comprehension problem there. He says he was born in Tunisia, has double Tunisian-Canadian citizenship, that he came to Canada 10 years ago. And he also said in that he did say that he works as a truck driver, but that he hadn't worked for 2 weeks. So it looks like he didn't use that fast card or use a truck to cross the border, although we don't know that for sure. But I think we could surmise that if he's not working.
So you've talked to his landlord, you've talked to his neighbors. Nobody saw any kind of indication that he was very angry at the U.S. and wanted to lash out.
None whatsoever. We check social media as well. He has almost no social media profile. He is on Facebook, but I had three posts like 2 years ago and nothing to suggest any kind of radicalism. We know the FBI said yesterday they don't have a sense that he is connected to any known terrorist group or anything. We have seen in Canada before, in Quebec, these kind of quote-unquote lone wolf attackers. There was a guy in a town about an hour from Montreal, Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, who a couple of years ago ran over with his car two soldiers and killed one of them. And he was just somebody who had, from Quebec, born in Quebec, who had converted to Islam. There was evidence that he had looked at jihadist websites and stuff, but basically he didn't have any connection with any terrorist group. We've seen other cases like that here as well in Quebec and in Montreal.
That is Steve Rukavina. He's a reporter for the CBC in Montreal. Steve, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Lester.
Ford Motor Company is breaking some rules. That's a statement that leads off today's column from Daniel Howes of the Detroit News. Daniel, you write that it's widely accepted in the global auto business, build where you sell, and Ford's going to violate that practice. What's happening?
Well, they've announced for the third time, which is very unique, their plans for the next generation Ford Focus compact car. Initially, it was going to leave Michigan, and it was going to be assembled in a brand new plant to be built in Mexico. They decided against that and moved it to an existing plant in Mexico. And now they've, for the third time, changed their mind and are going to produce it in China for sale in North America, which has really never been done before for an established model by a Detroit automaker. A lot of your listeners may know that there's a new Buick midsize SUV called the Envision, which the UAW calls the Invasion, that is assembled in China and brought into the United States. But it was a new model and a new size within their range of SUVs. I think this, taking an existing model that's really been around for, probably close to 20 years, and sourcing out of China is a new move, and I think it's going to be the beginning of some other bolder moves by Ford.
Well, let's go further into that in a second. But the Focus is currently being built in Wayne, Michigan. Mm-hmm. What happens to that auto plant and those jobs?
Well, those jobs will remain intact, and that's a very important point. Ford has said this. The Detroit News for the last 2 years have been reporting about what's going to happen to Michigan Assembly in Wayne. They're going to be building a Ford Ranger. They're going to be bringing the Ranger back to the United States. It had been here for a long time, as a lot of your listeners know, and then they killed it in the U.S. with the assumption that the F-150 F-Series trucks, the range of them could be sufficient for the truck market. I think they've realized that General Motors, in reviving the midsize truck, probably was doing the right thing.
So yeah, Ford, the little Colorado looks pretty nice.
Yeah, exactly. So they're bringing that back, the Ranger, and they'll start producing that, I believe, later next year, 2018. And then they're reviving the old name that a lot of our listeners know is the Bronco. Not exactly sure what that thing's going to look like, but it's going to be an SUV. They're going to be building that there in Wayne in 2020. So I think what you see here is, obviously, an admission, the car market, and this, particularly the small car market, is withering, and the profitability of building those vehicles in the United States is not what it needs to be, particularly when you're building fewer of them, so you don't get as big of economies of scale. At the same time, you're seeing them reinvest in trucks and SUVs because that's where the margins are, and I think they're making a bet, as are General Motors and FCA, among others, that over the longer term, oil prices are likely to stay lower than they are high. And we're having this conversation as we go into the summer driving season, and gas prices are collapsing right now. And usually it's the other way around, that as you approach July 4th, prices continue to tick up. That's not happening. There's a glut of oil in the market, and the United States has become one of the largest energy producers in the world, which is kind of an offset to the volatility in the Middle East.
Now, as you mentioned, kind of a net zero gain in jobs, no loss, no gain. But how does moving a production facility to China affect the relationship between Ford and its union workers?
I think any time China is a red letter word, I think, in the auto industry in a lot of ways, particularly when it comes to union relationships with the unions. I think the fact that the UAW is relatively quiet about this is indicative of the fact that they know that really what's happening here is an attempt to maximize profitability and to site in the United States plants that are going to be building more volume. And those two things put together for a more sophisticated understanding of the industry, and which they do have in Solidarity House, leads to more profitability, which it benefits the workers. Because remember, their profit-sharing checks are directly attributable and directly tied to the profitability of, in North America. And the more money they make as a company here, regardless of what they're selling, but let's assume for a second that they're selling more and more trucks and SUVs, which they are, the more money those workers are going to take home in profit-sharing checks every year.
You write it's still early days for Ford's CEO, Jim Hackett. What does moving focused production to China and the other changes signal as far as the direction Hackett wants to take the company?
Well, one, I think, is it signals that he's going to start making some tough calls. I mean, we've been watching, and I've been writing about and talking on your air about what General Motors has been doing in places like Russia. They've left Russia. They sold Opel after, you know, 90 years of owning it, essentially exiting all of the European market, which is incredible to me. But it's because they've done a cold, hard analysis, and they basically say, we don't think we're going to make any real money. It's going to have huge demands of capital, and we're going to be a bit player, 5%, 6%, 7% in a market where the biggest player is closer to 20%. So we're going to get out, and we're going to show the courage to do that. I think you're going to see more of that with Ford. I think this move going to China, amid the fact we haven't talked about it, but you've got a president of the United States who's talking about build America, buy America, invest in America, and is not afraid to use his bully pulpit to beat somebody about the head and shoulders metaphorically. But they're saying, you know what, we're running this company for the shareholders first. And if we don't, we're going to continue to get pounded in the markets. So I think they're going to do more of that. I think you're going to see potentially a decision on India. I wouldn't be surprised to see Ford say we're going to exit the Indian market, which, by the way, General Motors has already done. Particularly ironic because it's one of the fastest growing major markets in the world. And some people believe that it could be the third largest single market in not too distant future. So you may have a situation where the biggest American players say, you know what, we don't think we can play there, or we're going to make enough money there to be there, and so we're going to cede it to other people.
Daniel Hiles is business columnist for the Detroit News and a regular right here on Stateside. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Next Idea, encouraging creative thinking around solving health problems.
If you put five physicians in a room and ask them to come up with new solutions to old healthcare problems, they will come up with some solutions. But if you put an automotive engineer and a social worker and a ballerina in a room and you give them good mentors, it might blow your mind what they can come up with.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Candy. Coming up this hour, how algorithms shape our lives online.
For example, I'm Danish, but they think I'm Hispanic. And they think I'm Hispanic only because I like tango music on Facebook.
But first, yesterday, a man with a 12-inch knife stabbed a police officer at the Flint airport. He allegedly shouted out in Arabic, "God is great." The FBI says it's investigating the attack as an act of terror. The police officer, bleeding from the neck, fought with his attacker until other officers could restrain him. The officer, Lieutenant Jeff Neville, was treated and he will survive. The man arrested is 50-year-old Amor Fatui. He's from Canada. To learn more about the alleged attacker, we're joined by Steve Rukavina. He's a reporter at the CBC in Montreal. So, Steve, what can you tell us?
We know that he lives in a neighborhood in Montreal that's sometimes referred to as Little Maghreb. So there are a lot of mosques. There are a lot of North African immigrants that live in those neighborhoods. He lives in an apartment with his wife and three children. We know at this hour there are Royal Canadian Mounted Police and Montreal Police at that apartment, but they say they're just there to assist the FBI, which is leading this investigation. They haven't even told us yet if they've searched inside the apartment. And it's also not clear where Amor Fatui's wife and his three children are right now. We've spoken to his landlord and neighbors, and they basically say, as far as they knew, he was a quiet family man, that they're surprised that he would be accused of something like this. And we also obtained a copy of his resume, so we're learning a little bit more about his work background. He had worked in the past as a security guard. Last year, he obtained his license as a commercial truck driver, but it wasn't clear if he had worked doing that yet or not. His resume also says that he had something called a FAST card, which allows truck drivers, they can apply for that. And on both sides of the border, they can go through expedited lanes to get across more quickly. To get one of those cards, you do have to go through a rigorous background check, and you're not supposed to have a criminal record. We've run his name. He doesn't have a criminal record in Canada, as far as we know. We also have some information from the court appearance that he made yesterday. And apparently at that court appearance, he said he understands English, but mostly speaks French. So there was a bit of comprehension problem there. He says he was born in Tunisia, has double Tunisian-Canadian citizenship, that he came to Canada 10 years ago. And he also said in that he did say that he works as a truck driver, but that he hadn't worked for 2 weeks. So it looks like he didn't use that FAST card or use a truck to cross the border, although we don't know that for sure. But I think we could surmise that if he's not working.
So you've talked to his landlord, you've talked to his neighbors. Nobody saw any kind of indication that he was very angry at the U.S. and wanted to lash out.
None whatsoever. We check social media as well. He has almost no social media profile. He is on Facebook, but I had 3 posts like 2 years ago and nothing to suggest any kind of radicalism. We know the FBI said yesterday they don't have a sense that he is connected to any known terrorist group or anything. We have seen in Canada before, in Quebec, these kind of quote-unquote lone wolf attackers. There was a guy in a town about an hour from Montreal, Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, who a couple of years ago ran over with his car 2 soldiers and killed one of them. And he was just somebody who had, from Quebec, born in Quebec, who had converted to Islam. There was evidence that he had looked at jihadist websites and stuff, but basically he didn't have any connection with any terrorist group. We've seen other cases like that here as well in Quebec and in Montreal.
That is Steve Rukavina. He's a reporter for the CBC in Montreal. Steve, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Lester.
Ford Motor Company is breaking some rules. That's a statement that leads off today's column from Daniel Howes of the Detroit News. Daniel, you write that it's widely accepted in the global auto business, build where you sell, and Ford's going to violate that practice. What's happening?
Well, they've announced for the third time, which is very unique, their plans for the next generation Ford Focus compact car. Initially, it was going to leave Michigan, and it was going to be assembled in a brand new plant to be built in Mexico. They decided against that and moved it to an existing plant in Mexico. And now they've, for the third time, changed their mind and are going to produce it in China for sale in North America, which has really never been done before for an established model by a Detroit automaker. A lot of your listeners may know that there's a new Buick midsize SUV called the Envision, which the UAW calls the Invasion, that is assembled in China and brought into the United States. But it was a new model and a new size within their range of SUVs. I think this, taking an existing model that's really been around for, probably close to 20 years, and sourcing out of China is a new move, and I think it's going to be the beginning of some other bolder moves by Ford.
Well, let's go further into that in a second. But the Focus is currently being built in Wayne, Michigan. Mm-hmm. What happens to that auto plant and those jobs?
Well, those jobs will remain intact, and that's a very important point. Ford has said this. The Detroit News for the last 2 years have been reporting about what's going to happen to Michigan Assembly in Wayne. They're going to be building a Ford Ranger. They're going to be bringing the Ranger back to the United States. It had been here for a long time, as a lot of your listeners know, and then they killed it in the U.S. with the assumption that the F-150 F-Series trucks, the range of them could be sufficient for the truck market. I think they've realized that General Motors, in reviving the midsize truck, probably was doing the right thing.
So yeah, that little Colorado looks pretty nice. Yeah.
Exactly. So they're bringing that back, the Ranger, and they'll start producing that, I believe, later next year, 2018. And then they're reviving the old name that a lot of our listeners know is the Bronco. Not exactly sure what that thing's going to look like, but it's going to be an SUV. They're going to be building that there in Wayne in 2020. So I think what you see here is, obviously, an admission, the car market, and this, particularly the small car market, is withering. And the profitability of building those vehicles in the United States is not what it needs to be, particularly when you're building fewer of them, so you don't get as big of economies of scale. At the same time, you're seeing them reinvest in trucks and SUVs because that's where the margins are. And I think they're making a bet, as are General Motors and FCA, among others, that over the longer term, oil prices are likely to stay lower than they are high. And we're having this conversation as we go into the summer driving season, and gas prices are collapsing right now. And usually it's the other way around, that as you approach July 4th, prices continue to tick up. That's not happening. There's a glut of oil in the market, and the United States has become one of the largest energy producers in the world, which is kind of an offset to the volatility in the Middle East.
Now, as you mentioned, kind of a net zero gain in jobs, no loss, no gain. But how does moving a production facility to China affect the relationship between Ford and its union workers?
I think any time China is a red letter word, I think, in the auto industry in a lot of ways, particularly when it comes to union relationships with the unions. I think the fact that the UAW is relatively quiet about this is indicative of the fact that they know that really what's happening here is an attempt to maximize profitability and to site in the United States plants that are going to be building more volume. And those two things put together for a more sophisticated understanding of the industry, and which they do have in Solidarity House, leads to more profitability, which it benefits the workers. Because remember, their profit-sharing checks are directly attributable and directly tied to the profitability in North America. And the more money they make as a company here, regardless of what they're selling, but let's assume for a second that they're selling more and more trucks and SUVs, which they are, the more money those workers are going to take home in profit-sharing checks every year.
You write it's still early days for Ford's CEO, Jim Hackett. What does moving focused production to China and the other changes signal as far as the direction Hackett wants to take the company?
Well, one, I think, is it signals that he's going to start making some tough calls. I mean, we've been watching, and I've been writing about and talking on your air about what General Motors has been doing in places like Russia. They've left Russia. They sold Opel after, 90 years of owning it, essentially exiting all of the European market, which is incredible to me. But it's because they've done a cold, hard analysis, and they basically say, we don't think we're going to make any real money. It's going to have huge demands of capital, and we're going to be a bit player, 5%, 6%, 7% in a market where the biggest player is closer to 20%. So we're going to get out, and we're going to show the courage to do that. I think you're going to see more of that with Ford. I think this move going to China, amid the fact, we haven't talked about it, but you've got a president of the United States who's talking about build America, buy America, invest in America, and is not afraid to use his bully pulpit to beat somebody about the head and shoulders, metaphorically. But they're saying, you know what, we're running this company for the shareholders first, and if we don't, we're going to continue to get pounded in the markets. So I think they're going to do more of that. I think you're going to see potentially a decision on India. I wouldn't be surprised to see Ford say we're going to exit the Indian market, which, by the way, General Motors has already done. Particularly ironic because it's one of the fastest growing major markets in the world, and some people believe that it could be the third largest single market in not too distant future. So you may have a situation where the biggest American players say, you know what, we don't think we can play there, or we're going to make enough money there to be there, and so we're going to cede it to other people.
Daniel Hiles is business columnist for the Detroit News and a regular right here on Stateside. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Next Idea, encouraging creative thinking around solving health problems.
If you put five physicians in a room and ask them to come up with new solutions to old healthcare problems, they will come up with some solutions. But if you put an automotive engineer and a social worker and a ballerina in a room and you give them good mentors, it might blow your mind what they can come up with.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. This fall, two completely driverless shuttles will start running on the University of Michigan's campus. Researchers will be focusing on safety, but it's also a chance to see how people interact with driverless vehicles. Stateside's Tyler Scott got to ride in one of the shuttles at M-City, which is the university's testing ground for driverless and connected cars, and he has this audio postcard for us.
About to ride the Navia Arma. Okay. So this is one of the driverless vehicles that'll be shuttling Michigan students around campus this fall. It looks like a really small bus, but not having a driver's seat or a steering wheel frees up a lot of space. Surprisingly, like 15 people fit in here fine.
How did we all squeeze in here?
I don't know.
Safety is always our first priority here.
Carrie Morton is the assistant director of M-City. She's kind of leading us on the tour. All of us are just kind of hanging around talking, and the bus is driving along its pre-programmed route.
The shuttles operate in a very conservative manner so that if they even think they detect a person or a pedestrian, they're going to stop.
One morning early when I was unfortunately here by myself, it stopped for a fawn in the spring.
Or Canadian geese.
Or Canadian geese.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll do it.
That's Greg McGuire. He's the lab director at M-City. You can hear the air conditioning in the background, but the actual car is pretty quiet. In addition to being fully autonomous, it's electric too.
You can see signs that say powerful braking. That's because whenever the vehicle detects any kind of obstacle, it stops very abruptly.
She's not kidding. It's not long before we're talking and suddenly the car comes to a total stop, kind of shakes us all, and we're pretty surprised there's not really any warning.
Encountered a potential obstacle.
Yeah.
And so you can see why the safety handles are there.
We get going again, and Carrie's telling us that with these shuttles on campus this fall, researchers will get pretty much their first chance to study something they can't at a test track. They've attached cameras to the vehicles to study how people interact with the technology and whether they accept seeing driverless cars out on the road.
I think there are more questions than answers, and we found the best way to answer those questions are to learn by doing. So doing work here in M-City, then on campus, Ann Arbor, it's beyond the technology itself. It's more about the consumer acceptance, giving us a glimpse sort of into the future.
Eventually, it's time to head back. Greg, the M-City lab director, picks up what looks just like a video game controller. It's like the manual override. He can pick it up and steer the whole vehicle with the joystick.
We're gonna cheat since this vehicle is programmed for a bus route. We want to get back on the route without having to go all the way around.
It's not long, and we're back to the parking lot. This vehicle has a lot of glass on it, and the sunlight shines right through, and it can get pretty sticky.
Okay.
Thank you all very much. And the cool breeze. You can tell that humans put out quite a bit of heat energy once we are crammed in here.
Glass in this design.
Woo! It's hot. The whole concept of driverless cars out on the roads is kind of scary, but this one only goes about 10 miles an hour. And Carrie points out that getting rid of some of those anxieties about driverless cars is the whole reason for doing the research.
There's always going to be a hesitation with the unknown. And so coming together with a variety of sectors, not just the auto industry, but also the insurance industry, the telecom industry, the infrastructure providers, we can learn those lessons together so we can accelerate our innovation by gaining confidence of insights into the future.
For Stateside, I'm Tyler Scott.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. We keep hearing about the technological advances that are making the dream of self-driving cars a reality. But along with developing the technology, there must be guaranteed safety. And that comes through setting standards for connected and automated vehicles. This month, the American Center for Mobility at Willow Run entered into formal agreements with the Institute of Transportation Engineers and the SAE, the Society of Automotive Engineers International, to start creating those voluntary standards. We now turn to Andrew Smart. He's the Chief Technical Officer of the American Center for Mobility, and he spoke with Stateside's Cynthia Canty.
When we talk about standards, exactly what are we talking about?
It's the foundation for the technology. If you look at anything that we have around us today, standards are all around us, whether it be whatever you want to power your phone with. There are some standards for that, even the wall socket. It's three-prong or two-prong, it's standards. And if you have that, everyone can manufacture goods. It's really just the essence of what we do, but people seem to take it very much for granted. What's happened in the last few years as regards automated vehicles is the generation of the intellectual property and the technology has been going absolute gangbusters. But people obviously are developing it for themselves and their own technology for their own vehicles. And because of that, they really haven't had, one, the time, or in another sense, maybe almost the inclination to develop the voluntary standards, because that may give other people a leg up.
Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of overcome that inherent desire to hang on to my intellectual property.
There's a balance in all these things, and this will plateau in the next 12 to 18 months where people will find themselves, they've made certain announcements, this is this type of technology we're moving to, and so therefore people will become a little more open, because engineers, the challenge is if you get 250 of them in a room, one, to get them all to agree at the same time is a challenge in itself, but for all of them to almost give away the deepest secrets of what's going on won't be happening. So you've got to have a balance of where the technology is, and I think we're getting to that point.
And why is this the time, and maybe even past time, to start developing and having voluntary standards?
Well, we're really way behind. Normally, with any development work, standards soon follow, and then where appropriate, regulations follow that. But in this sense, standards process really hasn't kicked off in earnest.
So the big technological push has been going on.
Oh, absolutely. And that's way, way out in front. As we know, you can't pick up any newspaper or automotive journal without this kind of technology. And so now, vehicle safety. The last official figures, 35,092 lives were lost in 2015. 2016 went up 8% or so. We're probably up 8% or so again this year. That's just wrong. And so whatever can be done to reduce this is how we can make the push for the standard side as well. That's a key part of it too. So it all must come together.
So apart from the push for autonomous vehicles being, making life more convenient and I can do other things besides worrying about that line of cars ahead of me, you're saying we're absolutely talking about saving lives in this push.
Oh, absolutely. Over 100 a day. Yeah. It's almost become white noise now, which is disturbing to me. If you had that in terms of an aircraft a day went down with 100 people on board, that would be absolutely unacceptable. But here we are, and NHTSA are pushing as much as they can for certain regulation, working with industry. So there's a lot to be done.
So our transportation system that we have had since the beginning of the 20th century is starting to get threadbare. Looking ahead to the idea of mobility and autonomous vehicles, it's time for standards. So why are these three groups, the American Center for Mobility and the Institute of Transportation Engineers and SAE International, why are these the right ones to be creating these standards?
Well, we come at it from different directions. ITE is really looking at the transportation infrastructure. So when the vehicles are communicating with the infrastructure, that's required. Then when you look at the fundamental vehicles themselves, that's where SAE is required. And where ACM comes into this is we play very much a role as one to convene, but also to bring them together within the proving ground and safe proving environment to almost accelerate the deployment.
And it's neutral, so it isn't one car maker or one...
No.
So this is the idea that here you are. Here's the science. Here's the engineering. Okay, let's get everybody on the same page. So what's the process? You're basically creating something out of thin air, aren't you?
Thank you very much.
You really are. When you think about this is all
I'll
so
patent
new.
That. The processes themselves, ITE and SAE have been doing this for many years in their own bespoke areas, but bringing them together and almost in the standards arena, it's almost like the Wild West at the moment. Mm-hmm. Because if you imagine, at the moment, your car can be communicating to your audio system. So you're playing through there. You're talking through it and you can hear it. It's hands-free technology. So your phone is interacting. But then your car can then be communicating in some new models, communicating with the infrastructure as well. But what you have is almost a fundamental disconnect. 30 years roughly to put together total infrastructure, about 30 months to develop a vehicle, and about 30 weeks to develop a smartphone.
Boy, that's a lot to have to try to put together into one unit, kind of in a sense, all these movable parts.
So if you then say, well, how many advancements or how many iPhones or the like were we produced during the development period for a car, that would be many. And yet when the engineers are developing and designing the vehicle, when it goes into job one, it's got to interact with the phone of the day. So going back to your question of standards, interoperability, it all must work together seamlessly, because that's a major frustration for the end users.
Now, how long, you've begun the process of developing these voluntary standards, how long do you think it'll take before that process is complete? He smiles ruefully.
It's a never-ending story. Yeah. It's where to start. You look at all the technologies at the moment. Where we're starting on this is then really looking at outcomes, because we want to look at it almost being technically agnostic. And if you do it that way, then no one needs to share their own intellectual property, but it's what happens as the overall outcome. You can go to YouTube and read many press articles of incidents with automated vehicles. There are certain incidents that are well documented. There's some that aren't, maybe during the development process that people find things out. So we want to get into a situation where people start to share these things. And once they do that in an open forum, then we can start talking, well, if that's the outcome, how can we develop standards to test to that? And if we can test to it, therefore we can validate it, so therefore the vehicles are safe to go out onto the road.
And because there's zero room for error here. I mean, you're very aware of people's misgivings about autonomous vehicles. Start with, I don't want to be the one where they find out the system failed and I wind up going into the side of an abutment.
No, Control-Alt-Delete is not a function that you'll have in an automated vehicle, or the blue screen that you see on some things, or, you know, press it, you know, turn it off and turn it back on again and wait 10 to 15 seconds. That's not the option here. And because of that, it's foolproofing. It's then having all sorts of systems in place. And so that's where it's technically, it's very advanced. And when you have levels of artificial intelligence, that's another challenge you have. When you're trying to validate a product, you can validate a product in front of you, but if there's artificial intelligence, it learns.
And that's a process.
Exactly. And then rinse and repeat.
And then let's factor in the human factor. In fact, as you and I talk, the new report is out from the NTSB on that crash of the man who died driving the Tesla when it was on autopilot to hit a semi. And the NTSB has just released its report, and it found the driver ignored repeated warnings to put his hands on the wheel. And apparently, contrary to the reports we heard, he was not watching. The family lawyer insists he was not watching a video. But the NTSB report finds he ignored the warnings, put your hands on the wheel. So we've got that human factor. How do you, you can set all the standards in the world, and then you put a human behind the wheel.
That is, the human is, well, human in the loop.
Human in the loop.
And if you have the human in the loop, it's all about the education. And clearly, I can't go into the details of that, but it's all about education. And people, I'm finding at the moment, have a lot of faith in the technology. I'll give you one example. I was speaking to a young lady. I was asking her her vehicle, her driving style, et cetera, very interested. And she said, oh, yes, when the light in my door mirror goes out, I know it's safe to overtake. Hmm. And I stopped and I said, sorry, could you just repeat that? So a few cents of a bulb in that mirror goes off, and that's your absolute confidence without any other means to then step out into traffic. Oh, absolutely. Chills. You know, the hair's got up in the back of your neck and going, I said, madam, I would strongly advise you. You've been taught to look over your shoulder, use your mirror. That is only an aid.
So there's a lot of retraining that will have to happen as this technology is being developed, as the standards are being developed. So let's just freelance here. How long do you think it's going to take before we're not surprised by autonomous vehicles on the road, before they're commonplace?
I think people already have a vision of them, which again is concerning, because they already have a vision in their mind of what they're going to be. If you look at the deployment and the announcements, you know, 2021, around that time, we'll have some deployments in some urban areas, almost on a fleet basis. Some people might even say you might be a little underwhelmed by it, because absolutely safety critical. This is the first rollout of such vehicles in a fleet manner so they can be managed, ensure the deployment is working well. So that's the first phase. Then when you say, when will mainstream come on board, probably about 5 or 6 years after that, then we have 250, 260 million vehicles in the US. We sell 15 to 16 million a year. So I'll let your listeners do the mental arithmetic on that one to say how many years it will take just to turn over. But that's when everything is going to be automated. But people still like their 57 Corvettes and things like
sure
that.
Thing.
And then there still has to be the interoperability of cars talking to one another, cars that have no communication and some that have all. So when you look at when will it be fully mainstream, to me, towards the end of the 2020s, people will be far more comfortable with it. But then it's still a long, drawn-out process to get there. People's choice and people's education, again, to the technology and the faith.
You feel like a pioneer?
In some ways, yes. It really is, goes back to the safety aspect. It's a personal thing to me in terms of the saving of lives, the safety element to it and mobility. And when I hear the other stories, I just cringe and say, okay, we've got to do this sooner. And that's where it came to the standard side.
Andrew Smart is with the American Center for Mobility, where he's the chief technical officer. And I'm expecting to hear news pretty soon. Should we, by the end of the year or so, that out at the ACM, things are moving along? We're ready to put some vehicles on test tracks?
Yes, we are. The absolute focus at the moment, we call it the bringing the spirit of 42, everything that happened to Willow Run and what was done there in 18 months. And we're really trying to take that same spirit, because everything that we're doing is accelerated. Working with the local township, Ypsilanti Township. So I've got to go through the same motions that everyone else, but how can we streamline it? How can we expedite the situation? Bringing the people on board with construction. It's a different site. You see things going up and you learn so much more from a site that's been around for 75 years. Oh, it's a learning experience in more ways than one I can tell you.
Andrew, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Pleasure.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
There's so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours that we can't possibly know about all of it. That's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. So if you've got a question about Michigan, something you've always wondered about, send it along by going to Stateside's page at michiganradio.org. Tomorrow we talk with one of the Federal Reserve Regional Bank presidents. He's holding town halls. And the next one is in the UP.
A big part of my job is to represent our region when I go back to Washington, D.C., and then we set monetary policy for the nation. And so hearing directly from people who live in the UP is why I'm going there, and I hope people will come out to the town hall.
A conversation with the 9th District Federal Reserve Bank President Neil Kashkari on Stateside tomorrow. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Claire Bryan, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Candy. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.